Hello, and a very warm welcome to No Heathen Land, a podcast retelling macabre, intriguing, and just plain weird stories from the past, from God's own country, Yorkshire. In my opinion, Yorkshire is the perfect breeding ground for the most weird and wonderful tales. In Yorkshire, we have the rolling, vast countryside of the Dales, dark, tangled woodlands, remote back roads, but also industry, hard labour, a history of staunch religion, farming, tight-knit communities, immigration, a welcoming attitude, intolerance, riots. Much of this documented, a vast amount not. It's the stories in between the newspaper headlines that I really want to get into. Through my experience working in local history, it's really quite surprising how many odd tales you come across simply by looking into one single person's family history, for example. A newspaper article, a diary entry, a theatre playbill, a photograph. I'm very lucky to have made friendships and connections with interesting and enthusiastic people right here in Yorkshire. Each episode will feature one of them as a very special guest, where we'll delve into some of the stories we've come across that have fascinated, baffled, and sometimes unnerved us. Because of the subject nature of this podcast, some stories will not be suitable for everyone. Approach with caution. Hello and welcome to No Heathen Land. I hope you've had a good festive period, seasonal area, etc. Whether you celebrate Christmas or not, whether you've been working or resting, I just wish you well. Today's episode is going out on the 30th of December because the story took place on this very date, just a mere 562 years ago. This episode, I'm joined by my friend, fellow librarian and repeat guest, Josh Flint, who tells me all about the Battle of Wakefield at Sandal Castle. Josh, as you will hear, really knows this stuff about the War of the Roses, and this is an enthusiastic chat full of tangents and theories. I loved it, and I really hope you do too. As always, due to my insistence on being unprofessional, there's some shuffly noises and some cat noises in this episode, as always, as we were sat on the sofa fidgeting about, and my cat was in and out, causing havoc throughout, including getting in the Christmas tree, so I hope it's not too distracting. I'll be back at the end, as always, with information on where to find more. I hope you enjoy season 2, episode 3 of No Heathen Land. Okay, hi Josh, and welcome back to No Heathen Land.
Hi Sally, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So Josh was the second guest on A Heathen Land. And I think that's still one of my favourite episodes, I think.
You're just saying that.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, sorry. But I'm very happy to have you back. And in the intro to that second episode, I'd said that I was going to have you back at some point to talk about the War of the Roses in some capacity. So would you say that you are a War of the Roses enthusiast?
I would never say that, no.
Literally just said it before we started recording.
I love the War of the Roses. And I think for me, it's kind of, I've loved it since I was a child. I think it's such an interesting time period. I loved it when I was a teenager, and you kind of looked at it in different ways. And when I was a primary school teacher, I taught it. And we kind of did like, why did this side win the battle? And problem solve with kids. And now that I work as a librarian, I love it even more because we've got all these like books and artifacts on the War of the Roses.
I think you just skipped a part of your life there at university.
Oh, of course, yes. And then at university, I chose the University of Huddersfield because Dr. Glenn Ford, who was the person who found the new battlefield at Bosworth, and I really wanted to work with him, which I did for my master's, which is amazing.
Fangirled over.
Exactly. I know, yeah. Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you one story quickly.
Okay.
My favourite before we get started. The reason why I was introduced to the War of the Roses is because in every year four class, so I was nine, you learn about the Tudors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all great and it's all kind of, you know, Henry VIII and Elizabeth I, and it's all very fun. However, we started the wars, we started the Tudors by looking at the Battle of Bosworth Field, which for Nottingham is just down the road in Leicester. Mm-hmm. And we watched this video about the Battle of Bosworth, and it had Richard III being killed by Henry Tudor, complete made up, like it didn't happen this way at all, in hindsight. And ever since then, I was like, the Tudors are great, but I wanted to know more about that starting bit. And ever since then, yeah. I've just loved it. And so, since I was year four, mm-hmm. it's just been my favourite thing in the world.
Great backstory. Okay, so we're going to be talking about, well, I'm saying me, I don't know anything about it. I always feel like, I say to people, like, I know very little, but about loads of stuff. So yeah. This can just add to my pile of, like, tiny bits of knowledge that I remember. Mm. And I feel like with some of the battles in the War of the Roses, you've told me about them, like, numerous times, and it just kind of goes in and I'm like, cool, yeah. And then it falls out of the other side of my head.
Yeah, that's like, what a lot of people say about what I say.
So anyway, yes, so we're going to be talking about this specific battle mm-hmm. because of the date that it happened. So we had this planned to record about 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
And unfortunately, Josh was unwell, mm. and then I was unwell, yeah. and we work in the same place, and it's been very busy in the lead up to Christmas because no one else was working apart from us somehow. So we were going to go for a little trip, weren't we? Mm-hmm. A little field trip to the site where this battle happened, but that's been postponed. But I thought it'd be really good to get this episode out on this particular date, which is the 30th of December, and hopefully we'll go for a field trip in January.
Yeah.
So today's date is the 28th of December. We're still in the Christmas void. That's how dedicated I am to getting this podcast out on the right date. And do you want to reveal what the battle is?
Yes. So it's the Battle of Wakefield, which was on the 30th of December, 1460. Mm-hmm. And it's right at the beginning, kind of about 5 years into the Wars of the Roses. And it's the biggest Yorkist defeat to the Lancastrians to date.
Cool. So do you want to give like a tiny bit of background to the start of the War of the Roses and how it led up to this bit? You just pulled a face, so I was like, no.
I'm not entirely sure why I wasn't expecting this. So the War of the Roses starts, and this is one of the reasons why I like it so much, because it has so many different starting points. Mm-hmm. You can have the short-term effects, which are, the Yorkists and Lancastrians starting to really disagree with each other. But really, it goes all the way back to... So the War of the Roses is from 1455, and it goes all the way to 1487. So mm-hmm. it's a 32-year war between the Yorkists and Lancastrians. And
don't make them like that anymore.
Exactly. And during that time, one of the reasons why it's such an interesting time period is because it becomes a dynastic struggle that becomes a blood feud. Because it becomes, this person killed my brother, this person killed my father. And so these kind of views get entrenched on either side, mm-hmm. and really becomes a war of attrition. That the reason why Henry Tudor, who, spoiler, wins the War of the Roses in the end and begins the Tudor line is because he's the only person left on either side.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating, that every other person really is killed off, every other powerful person. Mm-hmm. But the War of the Roses really starts, so... The first battle is in 1455, but it really starts in 1399. Mm-hmm. It's about 56 years before. And it's because Richard II, who was the king at the time, is deposed. And he's deposed by Henry IV, mm-hmm. who is his cousin. And so the problem with that is that because he gets deposed by his cousin, people who are also cousins of Richard II also say, well, I've got just as much of a legitimate right as this person who's now king.
Yeah.
And that's fine when you have strong kings and kings that can dominate other noble families and like their own cousins and people like that, mm-hmm. Which is what Henry IV kind of did, and Henry V, his son, did, most notably at the Battle of Agincourt, mm-hmm. During the Hundred Years' War. But the problem really occurs in when Henry V dies, he leaves his one-year-old son as king of both England and France. Mm-hmm. And Henry VI, there's going to be lots of Henrys, lots of Richards during this. Henry VI, who is this baby, when he grows to adulthood, then is has lots of mental illness. And in 1453, so he's been king for about 30 years by this point, he goes into a catatonic state for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem that happens at the start of the War of the Roses is, who fills the power vacuum if the king can't fill it? Yeah. And then all these different strands of royal lineage come out and say, well, I'm the right person to take control. I'm the right person to take control. And that sows the seeds of the Wars of the Roses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the most powerful person in the country, the king, can't fulfil his role. And the second most powerful person, Richard Duke of York,
mm-hmm.
Actually, if you go back in history, has a better claim to the throne than the king himself. Did any of that make any sense?
Did look that like? yes, that does make sense. Thank you. I also did this at school, so it's in there somewhere.
Yeah,
it's in there somewhere.
I can tell.
Okay, so we're going to the Battle of Wakefield.
Mm-hmm.
So can you just remind us why this is? I mean, we're doing the Battle of Wakefield because it's in Yorkshire and because of the date. So.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, we have to concentrate on Yorkshire on this podcast, as always.
Always, yep.
Even though you're not even from here.
yep.
Always
remind me of that as well.
I do. Unbelievable. It's probably, like, a good half and half split now, to be honest. People that have been on the podcast who are actually from here and who
is it even a Yorkshire podcast anymore? I think it's debatable.
Yeah, well, the logo is the... Is a rose, but
yeah.
I mean, who knows what kind of rose that is?
That's
now
exactly, yeah,
spooky rose. we're just getting sidetracked. Okay, so could you just remind us why the Battle of Wakefield is significant with the War of the Roses?
Okay, so by 1460, the War of the Roses has been going on for 5 years.
Yeah.
What happens is that Henry VI is in this catatonic state for about a year,
mm-hmm.
And Richard Duke of York. There's this kind of power split between Henry VI's wife, which is Margaret of Anjou,
mm-hmm.
and Richard Duke of York, who is the king's cousin.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see where the Yorkist and Lancastrian kind of names come from, because it becomes very split. And both Margaret's alliance and Richard Duke of York's alliance start to vie for power of who can fill in this power vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And what I always find really interesting, again, I'm going on a bit of tangent, is that... Margaret of Anjou was from France.
Yes.
And the custom in France is if the king is either unwell or if he's gone to war mm. in another country, his wife's family takes over.
Okay.
And so that's what Margaret was expecting to happen.
Oh.
Yeah. But in England, the custom was that if the king is unwell or if he's gone to a different country for war, then the most powerful noble will take control, which in this case would be Richard Duke of York. And
yes.
So what I always find really interesting is that both sides are following the customs that they were always taught, but both don't coexist together.
Mm.
And so it creates distrust, it creates treachery, creates the nobles start to go on both sides and start to choose their own sides. And this culminates in 1454,
mm-hmm.
which is a year... So Henry VI has been in this catatonic state. There's been this year-long power struggle... between Margaret and York to see who would get the power, and York finally wins public opinion. And as soon as York gets all the power, becomes protector of the kingdom, Henry VI recovers, strips York of all his power,
mm.
and York goes into the wilderness, and that starts the War of the Roses.
Okay.
And so what happens, the first battle is in 1455,
mm.
and it's the Battle of St. Albans, and both sides are completely shocked that it actually ends up in war. And so...
Oh.
Yeah. And so even though it's a Yorkist victory, they have no idea at this point what they're actually fighting for.
Mm.
They don't know if they're... They just are completely shocked that it got to that stage. And so that's why there's not a battle between 1455 and 1459, because both sides are just a bit shocked about how this happened.
Yeah.
And actually, at St. Albans, the king gets an arrow in his shoulder,
mm.
even though he's not technically fighting. And both sides are a bit like, ooh, that went a bit far.
that's quite far.
Exactly, yeah. and railed back. And the problem with that is that, I really can't remember the date, but after the Battle of St. Albans, Henry VI orders a Love Day parade to happen throughout the city of London, and to kind of bring all the sides back together. And Margaret of Anjou has to walk arm in arm with Richard, Duke of York, going through the city for this Love Day parade. Actually, it went through Coventry, not London. Mm-hmm. And again, you can just imagine these two people who are fighting on different sides of the battle, like, you know, a year or so earlier, having to walk arm in arm through the city to say how great everything is now. Where actually, what was happening is that they were just sowing the seeds of these kind of the wars that were going to come.
Yeah.
And so, what happened is that both sides started to entrench themselves in their, you know, the political unions. And then by 1459, so 4 years after the first battle, York has started to become really, really estranged from everyone else. And more importantly, York and the Earl of Warwick started to become estranged, and they started to form a really powerful bond, which then ignited the rest of the Wars of the Roses, because they then decided what they wanted from this, which was to get rid of all the king's evil advisers around him and put their advisers in charge. But interestingly, there's a couple of battles that happen after 1459, like Northampton, and there's another battle of St Albans. But after the Battle of Northampton, this is where there's a real big change. And Richard Duke of York no longer wants to become the most powerful noble. He now then decides to become king.
Okay.
And so he wins at the Battle of Northampton, which is in October or September 1460. And he takes London, and he goes up to the throne, which, you know, and he touches the throne, and everyone's aghast in the court, because no one's meant to touch the throne except for the anointed king. And there's silence in the throne room, and until one of the archbishops say, "Ooh, are you here to see the king, Mr. York?" And that puts York back in his place, and he goes out of the country, and he goes out of the city, and he goes up to York. He goes up to Wakefield, which is the leads us to the battle that we've been talking about.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen you so animated talking about anything before. I love it. So can you tell us a little bit about the setting of the Battle of Wakefield, which is where we were going to go and visit and we haven't been yet? Although I have been as a child, because it's sort of quite close to where I grew up, and we were always at castles and museums and things. So I have been before, but not as an adult.
Interesting.
Yeah.
See, I'm from Nottingham, which has a massive kind of castle, which is right in the middle of the city, which is lovely. Makes it very hilly. But what I love about Sandal Castle, which is Wakefield, is even though it's been kind of torn down to a certain extent, there's only the remnants left, you really get the sense of what it was like at the time. It's on top of a massive hill. There's kind of different bits of brickwork and stonework.
Yeah.
Which is left from the original castle, and you can imagine this big hill which now looks over the houses which are now at the bottom of the hill. And at the time in 1460, it would just been a massive forest all around. And you can see why they chose that space, because you can see everything for miles, and you can see other armies coming up, you can see what's happening. It's just, it should be the safest place in the local area. But yeah, not in this case.
Yeah. So do you want to give us a play-by-play of the spell?
So,
minute by minute.
So I think one of the reasons why I find this battle quite interesting is, well, a couple of reasons really, but one of them is that both Lancastrians and Yorkists are fighting and both winning both battles each. You have to remember that there's not a royal army, or there's not a Lancastrian army, and there's not a Yorkist army. There's nobles that are Yorkist supporters that have their own army, and there's nobles that are Lancastrian supporters that also have their own army. And these separate armies on both sides are fighting each other all up and down the country. And so what you find that... And so what happens is that because both sides are winning battles and losing battles, they get to 1460. Richard Duke of York has given his... his will to become king, which is a massive change. And he goes to Sandor Castle to try and defeat, to try and go there, get some more reinforcements, and travel up further north where the Lancastrian army is, at Pontefract.
Yes.
So yeah, so the Lancastrian army is stationed at Pontefract, and the Yorkist army is stationed at Sandor Castle in Wakefield, which is 9 miles apart, which is, you know, so close to each other.
Yeah.
And there seems to be, I think the date is really important, because the 30th of December is obviously just after Christmas, and it looks like there was a Christmas truce.
Really?
Yeah, it looks like both sides said, okay, well, over during Christmas, mm-hmm. this time period, we're not going to fight each other.
Yeah.
Because if they were that close, there should have been something.
But so they were also having, like, the weird Christmas vibes exactly. that we're having right now.
Yes, exactly, exactly, yeah, yeah. Finishing a big battle.
Well, there's still time. It's only the 28th while we're recording this.
We've got 2 days. And I think that's I think that idea of a truce, even if it's kind of unwritten, even if it wasn't kind of, you know, explicitly written, or the fact that there was battles leading up to it and the battles directly after it, but during that time period there wasn't anything there. I find quite interesting, just the time period and the date itself. But I think the also thing that I found really fascinating about the War of the Roses in general is that you get all the treachery, and you get nobles changing sides every 5 minutes, and you get this kind of this unknown in Henry Tudor winning in the end, and you get the portrayed evil of Richard III, who killed his nephews in the Tower, whether you believe it or not, he did.
get your theory in.
But one of the reasons why there's so many different perceptions of what happened is because the actual chronicle evidence of the time period is lacking. There's not loads of written evidence. And which means that historians have put their own spin on it, because to fill in the gaps, to fill in the vacuum. Because the chroniclers and the authors just didn't write it down in detail. And so we don't know why things happened, because it's just not, the evidence just isn't there. And so so you can see during the time period that people are getting, the historians again, then getting frustrated and then starting to, you know, in essence, making things up that might make sense to them, but it doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah.
One of my favourite quotes for the War of the Roses from a historian is that they said, even the chroniclers were so embarrassed of what was going on in the country at the time that they refused to write things down. And it's not true, but you almost feel like that's true, because 100 years before the War of the Roses in the 14th century, during the Hundred Years' War, there's loads written.
Yeah.
100 years later, during the Tudor period, there's loads written.
Yeah.
During the War of the Roses, nothing.
Why do you think that is?
I mean,
What's your theory?
I think we're moving away. So what? Before the during the Hundred Years' War, there's always been more written when you're fighting France, because both sides write lots of things about what's going on, and you've got two countries' perspectives.
Yeah.
During the Tudor period, obviously getting the printing press as well, so things started to become a lot easier to then reproduce, even though it's very expensive. But I think the biggest thing is that those monastic chroniclers, which is what you relied upon during the earlier time periods, start to be less and less influential. And that turns into really important people writing histories in the future. But they just haven't really quite appeared yet. And so what you get during the War of the Roses period, you get these last kind of chronicles being written, like Cronan Chronicle. And then you also get kind of short-term chronicles being written by unknown people. Like there's tens of chronicles being written by London writers that no one's entirely sure whether they're written by the same person, whether they're written by different people within the same group. You're not entirely sure when they were written to a certain extent. You know, they could probably more closely to the War of the Roses than 100 years later. And so you're kind of moving away from the traditional chronicle, and you're moving into this new period, but you're not there yet.
Yeah.
And so that's why there's probably not much written.
That's really interesting.
And also, it just might be that some things don't survive.
Yeah, well, that's, you always find that. It's interesting. It is really interesting, because it's just so open to historical interpretation. And
yeah.
everything getting skewed and then people having their theories. It must be right, but then someone else has one and you're like, oh.
And it leads to the, you know, these great kind of spectacles, and we will get onto the battle. but at least these kind of great... you at least, like, you know, the other Warwick, which I kind of mentioned before, was a great supporter of the Duke of York. Mm. And he became known as the Kingmaker because he puts two people on the throne. One was a Yorkist and the other one was Lancastrian. Mm. So during the Wars of the Roses, the other Warwick swaps sides to the other side. And he goes and joins these people, the Lancastrian army, joins Margaret of Anjou and Henry VI. These people who for 10 years he's tried to kill and defeat and you know, get off the throne, and then he's trying to put them back on.
Mm.
And it's just because of power dynamics but the reasons why, there's not even a contemporary image of the other Warwick left.
Yeah.
And you think, you know, these people just have no idea what they look like, why they did what they did. Mm. You know, the whole thing about Richard III and, you know, why he took the throne from his brother, from his nephews, you know. You can track the 6 weeks that it takes Richard III to take the throne after his older brother dies, but we still don't quite know why, and that leads to, you know, lots of perceptions in Shakespeare that he's evil, or, you know, possibly the perceptions now that he's like a redemptive great man, but actually he's probably somewhere in the middle that he just got stuck somewhere and he panicked and he did what he thought was right to keep his power.
Yeah.
But it's because we don't know.
We don't know. But it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Come on then, battle time.
Okay. So you have this truce, and you have the Lancastrian army, or portion of it, at Pontefract Castle, in Pontefract. And you have the Yorkist army, or again, a section of it, with the Earl of York, Duke of York, his younger son, at Sandhill Castle. And what we know happens... Mm-hmm. At the battle is that on the 30th of December, Richard Duke of York leaves the safety of the castle. He goes to fight a larger Lancastrian army, and he's killed.
Right.
So the most powerful person in the country that's next to the king is killed in this big-ish battle.
Mm-hmm.
And my favourite thing that we have in the library about it is a contemporary chronicle called the Crowland Chronicle, which is written at the time, just after. But, you know, decade after, and all it says is there was a battle at Sandor Castle and Richard Duke of York is slain.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You know, this really important person is killed and it gets like a line or two.
Let's get to the point.
Exactly. And, you know, and so because of that, it raises all these questions. Like, we spoke before about, you know, how Sandor Castle is on a hill. You can see everything coming up. You can see these other armies coming up. And so it raised the question of, why, if Richard Duke of York knew that there was a bigger army coming to him, why did he leave the safety of the castle?
Mm.
Why would you go and fight this bigger army when you know you're probably going to get killed?
Yeah.
And so I do and so you kind of look at the contemporary chronicle evidence of the time, and there's not loads written about why. And part of me thinks it's because they don't know.
Mm.
And so the closest that we get is John de Warren, who was another chronicler, and he talks about how Richard he didn't realise the size of the army. And so he left the safety of Sandor Castle because he didn't realise the size. Which to me kind of makes sense enough. Mm. But that's one person who was writing about 30, 40 years later.
Okay.
And so again, when there's a lack of detail, people try to put in the power vacuum. People start to put in their own ideas into because it's a vacuum otherwise. And so what you start to find is that during the Tudor time period, they start to put their own spin on it. And so a chronicler called Edward Hall, whose book came out in the History of Lancastrian in York, the History of the Wars of Lancaster and York, which came out in 1550, so 100 years after the 90 years after the battle happened, he writes that there was Richard was called a coward, and he didn't like this kind of stain on his honour, so he knew that he was outnumbered, but he left the castle anyway because he didn't like being called a coward.
Mm.
Which, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you get 100 years after that, so you get to like the 1650s, and you have other writers who are writing at the time period, who are doing these great histories of the kings and queens of England, and they're starting to add their own items in and now. And so what's happening is that Hall's kind of perception of Richard being called a coward, and that's why he left the safety of Sandal Castle to get to go and fight his bigger Lancashire army, is now being treated as history and not kind of an idea.
Yeah.
And so they're starting to add their own spins to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not all, and so they're saying that, you know, he was definitely called a coward, and his honour didn't allow him to stay in the castle when he was going to be, to be seen as a coward and that kind of stuff, and he just didn't like it, and so he left the castle because of that. And then you've got other writers around the same time coming out and saying, actually, he was tricked. He was tricked to leave the castle, which one I love.
It's all coming back to me now, Josh. The trick, yes.
Yes, that you had. And this goes back to the whole thing about the Wars of Roses. Because people were changing sides all the time,
yeah.
That you almost sort of half had to expect people to change sides. And so one of the ideas that came back 200 years later, that kind of started to get a foothold then, was that Richard was coaxed out of the castle by people who were dressed in Yorkist clothes who said, oh, we're here to help. We're the reinforcements that you're waiting for. That, and then as they come out, he's just completely pounced upon by these other armies, by these other Lancashire armies. And again, you know, you think, oh, that could be plausible, but what's the evidence? Where's that coming from? And then what you find is that, you know, now you look at the kind of contemporary secondary texts, and they have to kind of start to unpick all these theories, because that's what they are. They're not historical fact, because if you go back to the original text, the Chronicles...
Well, there isn't any.
There isn't any. You know, and the ones that are there are very scarce.
Yeah.
And so what do you do with that? One of the ideas that I do like, which kind of comes from a more recent historian, you know, within the last 100 years, is that they said that actually what's probably most likely has happened is that... Richard was starting to run out of food. They knew that they were probably surrounded by a bigger army.
Yeah.
They knew that they were probably going to start to run out of food, and so he thought, I may as well preempt this rather than being waiting for a siege. But that historian says themselves, that's not necessarily based on fact. That's based on their experience of being a historian, knowing how these things normally work, and taking ideas of what happened at other battles and putting it on this battle.
Yeah.
Because the evidence just isn't there.
Yeah.
And so you have this really powerful episode that's happened, this war, and the most powerful person in the country next to the king has been killed.
Mm.
And really, that should be the end of the Wars of Roses, just there. Mm. It isn't. there's another like 27 years. but it should be the end by all rights, and it isn't. But there's just nothing really that we know about it. Mm. Which again, I think the mystery is compelling.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can see how a lot of these theories and historical fact has played into a lot of films, a lot of TV now, especially because it is that like, well, what really happened?
Yeah.
Let's make a drama out of it.
Yeah. I mean, my favourite thing is, so I do a talk, I'm going to plug it, about the Yorkshire Battles. It's like a library talk.
I've seen many times.
You have, yeah.
Yes, still can't remember anything.
It shows the power of the way I talk. I think that's the...
No, it's definitely more a reflection on my brain.
And what I always do is compare, I go through which we just have, which is, you know, you start with the contemporary chronicles, which don't really say anything, and then you go to 100 years after, and they start to add more of a layer to it, and you go 100 years after that to the 1650s, and you add more of a layer. And then I go to Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And I go to the scene in Richard III, which has, Henry VI, part 3-ish. And so you, which depicts Sandal Castle, the Battle of Wakefield, and you have Richard Duke York losing the Battle of Wakefield, being dragged to Margaret of Anjou, and being given a... She says, I'm not going to talk to you until you wipe your brow, because he was all kind of muddy and bloody. And she pulls out a red handkerchief, and he gets her to... You know, he wipes his brow, and she says, ha, you've just wiped this, that handkerchief is only red because it has the blood of your young son on it. Evil, you know,
yeah.
Complete fiction. Like, you know, Margaret wasn't anywhere near Wakefield at the time. Richard Duke York's son was 17. He wasn't like 9, which is how Shakespeare depicts him when he was killed. Richard Duke York was more than likely killed on the battlefield and not dragged to this kind of magical place where he confronts Margaret Barnes. You always find in Shakespeare plays that these people confront each other, even though they're like on different sides of the country. But again, Shakespeare is just adding different layers to things, which is what these historians are doing. But one is we know is fake, and the other people were meant to believe. And I think that kind of... I find that so interesting.
It's so interesting.
And Shakespeare has you know, a lot to answer for with the War of the Roses, because people believe so much stuff that he says about it.
People believe a lot of, more than just stuff about War of the Roses from Shakespeare.
Exactly.
He's a fiction writer.
Exactly, I know. My favourite story about the War of the Roses is, and I've told you this many a time, is that, and again, it's because I'm from the East Midlands, and so I'm from Nottingham, so Leicester is very close to us, and that's where the Battle of Bosworth happens, which is where Henry Tudor defeats Richard III and becomes king. And Bosworth, and it was always thought that Bosworth was fought on this hill called Ambion Hill. And it was thought so much that the Leicester City Council gave a grant for there to be a...
The cat is all over the place. Oh, God. Sorry.
So, the city of Leicester paid for a heritage centre to be made at the where they thought the Battle of Bosworth was, around this Ambion Hill.
Yeah.
And then actually, the person who I studied under, Dr. Glenn Ford, he figured out that, you know, actually the battle was 2 miles down the road, because that's where he found all these kind of cannon shells and that kind of stuff. Mm. And if you go back in history, the first person to say that the Battle of Bosworth was fought at Ambion Hill was Shakespeare. And that's what has always been believed ever since.
Yeah.
And if you actually go onto Ambion Hill, you can't fit 20,000 people on that hill. It's tiny.
Mm.
You know, but that's what people always thought happened, because that was the accepted, because that's where you fight battles.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there's no evidence for it. The evidence came from Shakespeare 100 years later.
Yeah, evidence in quotation marks.
Exactly.
what happened? Do we know what happened immediately after this battle ended, the Battle of Wakefield?
So, Richard Duke of York was more than likely killed on the battlefield.
Yeah.
His body was then dragged to York, and his head was severed from his body, and was put on with other Yorkist allies. Was put on a spike on the gate of York, and it had a paper crown on it.
Oh,
I know.
Ouch.
Yeah. And later, his later chroniclers, talking 100 years, 200 years later, say that people used to go there and bow to this kind of fake king and that kind of stuff. And there's actually, you know, and then the paper crown became a crown of... thorns, like what happened to Jesus, and I think there is depictions of that as well. I can't quite work out why people who hated the Yorkists would depict York as Jesus. I'm not entirely sure where that comes from.
Yeah.
But you know, it's made up. So you know,
it's a cool story.
It's a very cool story. but the paper crown did more than likely happen, because that was a very common thing that happened at the time. To behead someone was seen as such a horrendous act anyway, because obviously religious terms. And then to kind of depict this person who wanted to be king as a paper king.
Mm.
Had so, you know, the symbolism is all there, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then that by all rights should have been it.
Yeah.
But the thing about the War of the Roses is that then that just entrenched divisions.
Yeah.
And so that should have been this glorious moment for the Lancastrians and Henry VI and his wife Margaret of Anjou and their biggest supporter, the Duke of Somerset. You know, their biggest rival, Richard Duke of York, has been killed. But what happens is that his 19-year-old son, Edward, Earl of March, then takes up the mantle of the Yorkist regime, and rather than doing what his dad did, which is like, oh, I want to get rid of your advisors. Mm. I want to become your best advisor. Actually, no, I want to be king. He strips all that away and says, no, I'm going to be king. And so Edward then starts to win battles. Mm. He wins the Battle of Mortimer's Cross, which is just outside of Wales. And this leads to the Battle of Towton, which again is in Yorkshire, which is the most horrific battle on British soil. Mm. Because more than likely, 60,000 people fought there and 35,000 people died.
Whoa.
Which is more than any other battle on British soil.
How long did that last?
All day.
All day long.
And you have to remember that, you know, most battles, like say Bosworth, Sandal, we don't know about the Battle of Wakefield, how long it lasts, but it wouldn't have lasted long. It was a rout. Yeah. You know, Richard Duke of York was surrounded and killed very, very quickly by a bigger army. The Battle of Wakefield, the Battle of Bosworth finishes in about an hour, because Richard III is killed very quickly.
Yeah.
He does this desperate charge to try and kill Henry Tudor, and you know, he gets killed along the way. Mm-hmm. So battles normally end because either one side is routed very quickly, or because the person who's leading the battle on one side is killed. The problem at Towton is that neither of those things happen. And so because both sides are evenly matched, and because neither commander is killed, it's a war of attrition. Yeah. Which means it just keeps on going and going and going until one side gives up. And, you know, that was the Lancastrians in the end. Towton, I think there's so much imagery about Towton that the battle was fought on Easter Sunday. And it was snowing, really, really windy. And you have the Yorkists who were kind of using the wind to make their arrows go further, and the Lancastrians whose arrows couldn't go as far because the wind was going against them. Mm-hmm. And so you had the Lancastrians and the Yorkists stationed about as far away as they normally would be, but the Lancastrians' arrows would stop and land just before the Yorkist army, and then the Yorkists would come forward, pick up the arrows that they've just been shot at them, and fire them back. But even then, you know, the fighting lasted all day in the snow and the wind, and they're wearing this kind of really heavy armour. And it just was a battle of who gives up first, and that was the Lancastrians. And that was 35,000 people more than likely died on that battlefield, which just is, you can't imagine it at all.
No, I absolutely can't. I can only, you know, think of it in terms of, you know, films.
Yeah.
And Game of Thrones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And all. Yeah.
And this is it. Like, you know, Game of Thrones is great and it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. But the real life events of what happened during the War of the Roses, which a lot of the early scenes of series of Game of Thrones is based upon.
Yeah.
It's just so much weirder. It's, you know, it has... one of my favourite stories, actually, is so you have, at the end of Battle of Towton, you have Henry VI gets away. He loses the throne, but he gets away. And Edward Earl of March becomes Edward IV. This 19-year-old kid, in essence, has won two battles and is now king. And he has his most powerful ally, the Earl of Warwick, sat on his right-hand side. Everything's great for a few years. And then Edward gets married to someone who the other Warwick doesn't like, which is Elizabeth Woodville. Don't get me started on... I can't remember the author's name now. The person who writes all the White Queen.
Oh, yeah.
Philip and Gregory.
Yes, yeah.
I'm sure she's great, but I can't do it.
That's very kind of you.
So Edward marries this person who's kind of, you know... the other Warwick doesn't agree with. And then what happens is that after 8 years of this kind of almost peaceful reign, the other Warwick, who's starting to get annoyed that he's losing power over this kid who's now turning into a man, who's starting to think, actually, I don't want to take orders from this other person now. I'm king. I'm great. I can do whatever I want. Warwick changes sides and he becomes a Lancastrian. And what's most interesting is that Edward IV's younger brother, Clarence, also changes sides and becomes a Lancastrian.
Oh.
Yeah. Crazy.
Crazy.
And the Earl of Warwick then tries to put, and does succeed in putting Henry VI back on the throne.
Mm-hmm.
And then Clarence, Edward's younger brother, changes sides again and becomes a Yorkist again. And helps his brother regain the throne.
Whoa.
And then rebels again.
It's like a soap opera in itself, isn't
it? It's ridiculous. And then he rebels again and is finally killed in 1476. Mm. And he's drowned in a barrel of wine.
Sounds all right.
But you're like, you know, no,
that sounds awful.
But this is it. Like, you know, you have this ridiculous farce, you know, which would be a farce if it wasn't so serious, of this brother of the king changing sides again after that, and then being killed in this ludicrous way. And that's all true. And you think, you know, you wouldn't believe it if it was made up, would you?
Wow.
Yeah. I feel like I've tired you out.
I started like slowly late. I'm back on the sofa. No, Josh, that was fascinating. Genuinely. It's great. And I love seeing... I love enthusiasm when you're just so excited about it. I love it. Is there anything else that you wanted to add about the Battle of Wakefield or the War of the Roses itself? Have you got anything else that you want to shout at me about?
It kind of turned into the War of the Roses.
Well, the cat is in the Christmas tree.
I think it's just such a fascinating time period, and it's one which I've always found interesting. Mm. And I always remember watching this, as you do when you're a cool young teen. I was watching the History Channel, and there was a documentary. There was a documentary about the War of the Roses, and it was at a time where I kind of knew. I must have been about 12, 13, and I kind of knew bits and pieces about it, but it was the first time I was properly learning about how things happened. And it was during half term, which is when all the best documentaries are on. And each day had a different War of the Roses episode on. And I got to Thursday, and everything was great. Everything was fine. Everything works out. Edward IV is doing okay on the throne. He's just got it back. And I was like, okay, well, this is kind of that then. I was like, how does this get to the Tudors? And then at the end of the credits, it had the trailer for the next episode, and it just had Richard III's face, and I was like, oh, okay, yep, there we go. That's how we get there. Mm-hmm. And you think, because it's just nuts.
Yeah.
And I can't recommend anyone kind of, you know, reading about it, watching documentaries about it. I think one thing actually, which I do think needs to... I think is interesting is the portrayal of Henry VI, who kind of goes into a catatonic state.
Yeah, we've definitely talked about this before.
Yeah, and I think what I always find quite interesting is that, you know, mental illness is now starting to become, you know, actually accepted. And
this was a long time ago, though.
It was a long time ago, absolutely. But if you go to the chronicle evidence at the time,
yes,
they don't say he's weak. All that often.
Yeah.
The perceptions of him being... They say he's you know, not a great king, and, you know, he made bad decisions. But this idea of him being a weak king because of his mental illness is a later addition. And I think that is something which... And you even see documentaries now, and you hear things like, oh, he was a weak, lazy king because he had these mental health difficulties.
Yeah.
And I think that's something which I find uncomfortable.
Mm.
Outside of all this kind of slaughter and misery... Yeah. I think sometimes that depiction is something which I think is starting to get better.
Yeah, that in turn is a lazy depiction, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yeah. So. Yeah. And I think that's what I'm getting to now, I hate it in myself, really, because I love watching documentaries about these kind of time periods, but as soon as I hear a historian, a well-respected historian, say that, use those kind of lazy terms, it just puts me off whatever they're going to say about everything else, because I feel like that's... is a hard position to get out of.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just find that quite interesting.
It's interesting. Thank you so much.
No, that's all right.
Is there anything else you want to say? Surely you've got another story in there.
No.
No, thank you. That was absolutely fascinating. And obviously everything that we talked about that I can link. Josh has got a book in front of him. It's brought with him to my house.
Yeah.
What's this called?
It's The Military Campaigns of the Wars of the Roses, and it's by Philip A. Haig. It goes through each of the battles, and it's great.
I've got to say, Josh's knowledge is so good that you bookmarked a page, you didn't even look at it.
Yeah, well,
that was all off the top of your head.
It's all made up, that's why.
You're just adding to it.
Exactly.
You're adding to the mix.
I'm the worst one. There's definitely some dates, and there's definitely some things in there that are incorrect. But, you know, it's War of the Roses, so no one knows anyway.
Every time I say anything on this podcast, it's theory. It's just theory. It's just Sally theory.
Exactly. So, dangerous Sally theory.
Yeah, so we just move forward, it's fine. At the end of each chat, I usually ask what you've been enjoying. If there's anything that you wanna recommend. We have literally just had Christmas, so
yeah.
I feel like it's a good time to watch TV, particularly, or experience things.
Yeah, so actually, I've got a couple of things.
Good.
Luckily, I've been watching Grey's Anatomy, which is awful.
I've never watched Grey's Anatomy.
It's just ugh.
But you've still been watching it.
Oh, it's like
I think I might have said, maybe I said on the last podcast. Josh's taste in stuff is really fun. You have a very eclectic taste in everything.
I'll take that as a compliment.
It is. Yeah, it is. Okay, Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, so Grey's Anatomy, which is just ridiculous. You know, you have one character who within... The problem is that, say, I love Scrubs. Mm-hmm. And it's not Scrubs by any stretch. But the Scrubs, you have... Each season is a year in their lives.
Right.
So you kind of... You're tracking their... You have some sort of concept of how long they've been a doctor for, whatever. In Grey's Anatomy, I've got to the fourth season and they're still on their first year. And in that time, someone's been, like, you know, someone's been, had a bomb which has kind of gone off in the hospital. Another person's, parents have both kind of died. Their partners engaged them and then they've kind of left them and then come back. And, you're like, this is like, someone's got married in Vegas and then got divorced. And you're like, this is like, you realise it's like a year. And you think, this is ridiculous. Anyway.
And yet you're still,
it's still
pursuing it.
The thing is, it's got like such good actors in it. Like, you know,
it does, doesn't it?
Yeah, Katherine Heigl and Sandra Oh. It's incredibly acted. Patrick Dempsey. It's just rubbish. But it's like, if it's just so well acted that it's like,
such
it's endearing.
A hot take.
Exactly. So I will watch all 19 seasons and I'll go from there.
Yeah, you'll have to report back next year.
I've also been watching the Twin Peaks: The Return as well.
It's still saved. I still haven't watched it. How we talked about Twin Peaks on the last.
Oh, did we?
We did.
Oh, wait.
Because we both love it.
Oh, is it me saying how terrified I am about angels?
Yes.
Oh, is it? Okay, that's normally where that goes. It's all right. It's one of those where it's like, it's incredible. I've watched the first 6 episodes and there's 18, and it's just incredibly slow. And I'm kind of, I want to get through it and then rewatch it so I can actually kind of know what the point is.
Yeah, I mean, it's been out for like three years or something now, and I still haven't watched it. And like, some people were like, it's amazing, and then some people are like, I absolutely hated it.
I
will watch it, and then I will report back and we can talk about it.
And then finally, so one more that I watched with my parents while I was back home for Christmas, is Goodfellas. Never seen Goodfellas before.
Oh.
And it was incredible.
So 2022 has been my year of gangster films. I've watched all of them. I love them.
Yeah.
Have
you watched Goodfellas?
Congrats on your Goodfellas viewing.
I always remember watching The Godfather and thinking, that's really good, but there's
right,
bits
long
in
it.
It's long, and I hate the whole Sicily bits. Where the person gets blown, his fiance gets blown up at the end. I just don't. Anyway, where the Goodfellas was just brilliant. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I was like, I'll watch 10 minutes of this and I'll probably get bored. But no, it was the best thing I've seen since the day before when I watched Anna and the Apocalypse.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now the cat's sniffing the dictaphone. Come on. I've got two things that I've watched. It's just two Christmas specials. So one of them was the Detectorists Christmas special. On the next episode of the podcast, which I've already recorded, which is going to be in January, we talk about the Detectorists on there. Have you watched the Detectorists?
No.
Okay.
Never will.
It's a BBC series.
Oh,
about
yes, no,
Detectorists.
Yes, of course.
And yeah, the Christmas special was good. It was long. It was like it was over an hour. And there's not been a series of it for a couple of years. And it was quite like low mood. It was a little bit sad, I guess. But it's just so good. Like, the acting's great, and it kind of goes with the theme of today, because they are the detectoring on a battlefield. I'm not going to spoil it, because it did just come out like 2 days ago.
Interesting.
Yeah, but it was very good, so I enjoyed that very much.
Is it made up, or is it true, or is it...
No, it's dry, it's a drama.
Oh, okay.
It's good. And then the other one that I watched was the Inside Number 9 Christmas special.
Oh, is that good?
I really liked it. I usually probably find terrible. That they can be a tiny bit hit and miss. I usually like them, but there's like 8 seasons of it now, and it's an anthology series, and they're just like... Everything that Reese Smith and Steve Pemberton do, I just love. They're just my favourite writers, and they're just so clever, and like how you can do like 8 seasons of an anthology.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, the Christmas special's good. It's set in a church, and it's like creepy, but a little bit, there's obviously like a lot of comedy in it as well. And yeah, it's a cool story. It's a good, like, it's a good little twist at the end, but it's not... It's not too out there. Mm. Yeah, very enjoyable. Oh, so that was my other... that's my other recommendation.
Hot take.
That's not a hot take, it's just a take. It's a take. so we'll leave it there. So thank you so much. I very much enjoyed your enthusiasm. And that's going to be a fabulous 30th of December release. I've put it out there now, so I have to edit it tomorrow and then get it out without anything going wrong, which is not usually what happens to me. Yeah. So
we didn't say this year, did we?
We didn't say this year. I could save it for next year if it doesn't work out. So yeah, happy new year, Josh.
Oh, thanks, Annie. Thank you for having me. And,
you're very welcome.
Happy new year. I'm going to see you tomorrow anyway. So yeah, the 29th, but yeah happy new year.
See you tomorrow at work.
Exactly.
Bye.
Bye.
What a ride, eh? A huge thank you again to Josh for joining me for this episode. If you haven't listened to season 1, episode 2, Murder at the Malt Mill with Josh, I urge you to go back and listen to that too. It's a great episode. As I mentioned in that episode, Josh is not on social media, so is almost untraceable. But please send me a message or a tweet at No Heathen Land, and I will pass on any and all compliments, which are very well deserved. The texts available that Josh mentions in this episode are linked in the description, as always, along with a blog post that Josh wrote a couple of years ago summarising the Battle of Wakefield. So finally, I want to wish everyone listening a very happy new year and all the good vibes and energy for 2023. Thank you so much if you've listened or sent me messages this year. I feel like I've finally found my stride with No Heathen Land, and I'm pretty proud of my relative consistency. That all comes from like actually enjoying making this podcast so much. I'll be back with a bang in January. The episode is already recorded. So take care of yourselves and others if you can. Goodbye.